This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about autism as a factor in mental health, and I'm getting an opportunity in today's episode to collaborate as part of a campaign by the National Autistic Society called Now I Know. And this looks at the experiences of women and non-binary people who have been diagnosed later in life with autism. And our guest today, Lex Lancaster, is one of the people featured in this campaign, who was such a delight to chat to. You know, someone that I connected to really immediately, which was really lovely, to the point where I was like, okay, we need to get on mic before we say too many interesting things off air. Because whilst I have no shame about repeating myself on mic if I think I made a good point off it, I'm never going to expect other people to be used to that not being strange. And in this episode, we go into a deep dive of Lex's experiences navigating autism, particularly when not knowing that you have it, and all the ways that you adjust to the outside world and the differences between other people. You can put so much effort into navigating yourself and trying to always make that leap, and then going on to then getting the diagnosis and for the first time getting the experience of being able to invite people into your reality, your perspective on the world. Also, a big part of Lex offering themselves up to be part of this campaign was to do with representation and not seeing people they related to through common representations of autism, and most specifically around the intersections of autism and gender, not just in how it can influence diagnosis or lack thereof, but also in how for Lex, receiving this diagnosis became a really crucial part of understanding themselves better and realizing their identity as a non-binary person. And so without giving anything more away, I've hopefully sprinkled a bit of the breadth of today's conversation, one that I found very uplifting. There were lots of giggles alongside the serious moments, and I'm enjoying really embracing that in these conversations as a way to take some of the power out of the stigma and make for conversations that run the emotional gamut, because isn't that human? Anyway, before I go into a tangent, we will wrap up my intro there and get into the interview with Lex Lancaster in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. If you've considered taking supplements to support a healthy, balanced diet, it can be really difficult to know where to start. That's a big reason why multivitamins are so common and so popular, because we end up just throwing everything at it and being like, I know I'm missing one of these, so we just take all of them. A lot of the time it's unnecessary, and you'd be better off having more targeted vitamins added into your life. That's why today I'm talking about Vital, a personalized supplement company that takes all these choices out of your hands by creating personalized vitamins for you. All you need to do is fill in a short online consultation about your diet, health goals, and other lifestyle factors, and Vital will create a tailor-made pack just for you. Then your personalized bright yellow pack of vitamins gets delivered directly to your letterbox with daily strips so you don't forget to take them, and even your name written on each pack. Best of all, this entire service is backed by science and created with people in mind who have tried vitamins in the past and haven't noticed a difference. Instead, these are designed in a way to ensure the highest quality with only clean, natural ingredients and no strange or nasty additives that many high street brands include. So, if you're looking to take charge of your health and fill some gaps in your diet, head to vital.com, complete their quick online consultation, and get a 2-week free trial as one of our listeners. You just need to enter the code mentalhealth. And when I say that, it's vital.com is how we're spelling it. They're such a great and efficient brand, they don't even need the A. So it's vital.com with code mentalhealth at checkout. It's a brand so good, they called it Vital. I hope you realize I make up these taglines.
and they really entertain me. One of these days, a brand will take one on, and that's how I know I've won. Now go get your vitamins.
Hi, I'm Lex. I'm nearly 36. So yeah, some of my early childhood memories are really hard to remember because I disassociated so much for so much of my childhood and even in my teens, a lot of my 20s and 30s. But being a kid, it's really hard to look back on when people ask me to remember things that are related to my autism and how I felt and how I was perceiving the world. And a lot of my memories are what people have told me, or home movies, or, you know, from my siblings, what they've told me. Mm-hmm. So it's been really hard sometimes to piece together the truth, well, how I feel about my truth. And it is sometimes really overwhelming. And I have slowly uncovered and remembered a lot within therapy. It is quite scary, these huge gaps of years where I really don't remember. There are sort of groups of years that I do remember, but sort of before 15 is very blurred. I just remember mainly just feeling uncomfortable, feeling really, really uncomfortable everywhere, very scared, all internal. Nothing was outward. I wasn't a naughty child. Everyone said I was very quiet and polite and pretty. And I just sort of became what everyone told me I was, essentially. But with all this internal screaming inside, which obviously eventually did come out as I got older, because I couldn't hold that all in anymore. And yes, school, there are a couple of situations where I just remember maybe talking to a couple of girls and they were talking about boys and I tried to join in and it just became extremely awkward because I didn't know how to talk about it. And I was just sort of trying to copy them because that's what you learn with autism. You learn to mask and you learn to sort of copy other people. So I would just hear things people would say and literally just repeat it in a different situation with someone else and think, oh, hopefully this will work. And if it worked, I'd do it again in another situation with someone else. If it didn't work, I'd try and find another little path to go down to, maybe change one word. And that wasn't all conscious thought, though. I think my brain was just scrambling around, trying to find a way to fit in, really.
Yeah, well, because the way you describe it there is so logical, but at the time it's survival. It's I don't feel I fit, and I'm desperately trying to clutch to, okay, everyone else looks like they fit. You know, because we all have that mask. And so you're like,
yeah,
I'll just do what everyone else is doing. Yeah. I'll just fancy all of the same list of boys. And then if people ask me, then I have all my answers ready.
Yeah. I remember Take That was huge when I was at school. I never got into Take That. And I remember at the time Take That were huge, and like girls were crying about them and all that sort of thing. I just couldn't get behind. I was listening to the Bee Gees. I had like a Bee Gees tape cassette. I used to love, like, we'd listen to, like, Simon and Garfunkel and things like that, that we were brought up on, Pink Floyd or whatever, like, my mum brought us up on that. So I remember sort of telling people at school that's what I listened to and, you know, them just taking the mick out of me for it. They were all into Take That and I felt like I should have been into that boy band. And, yeah, it's really hard to sort of pretend you're interested in something when you're not and you know nothing about it. I had to pretend to be interested in football for some of the boys. Like, it was all about Manchester United or something. I'd be like, yeah, yeah, I like football. It's just, yeah, it was really sad thinking about that child in me who had no idea who they were, because at that point, they'd still been masking quite a lot at that age to try and fit in. And I feel I've lost a huge part of who I am. I don't really know because I've been masking for so long with autism. It's sort of hard to pinpoint what is really me. Am I masking? You know, is this genuine? It's such a minefield to, as an adult now, trying to sort of unpack that and work out all these sort of past experiences. But secondary school was really difficult as well.
I just want to pause on that, actually, what you said about masking, that it's so interesting how indifference we often find out about ourselves. You know, like, by contrast for me, I don't think I would have ever convincingly pretended to be interested in football. So I don't think I bothered. And so instead I had to find out, okay, what am I interested in? Because people need to talk to me about something. But I think, like you've described there, when your focus is so, okay, I've got to try and mirror other people's behavior as a kind of faux way to create belonging, that at the time feels like the solution, but maybe didn't kind of actually satiate that. It can deny you, okay, what am I interested in instead? What do I actually like talking about? because the focus is, what do I feel I should like talking about?
Yeah, yeah. It was all should. And I try not to use that word as an adult at all. So I've learned in therapy. I try not to say should at all. I should be doing that. No, I shouldn't have to do anything. But it's very much was that, yeah, every part of my sort of childhood, probably even up to my 30s, my early 30s, was still, you know, trying to just copy other people, make other people feel comfortable. I don't ever really feel like I was ever asked, is this okay for you? Are you happy with this conversation? Are you happy with us doing this? I always felt forced into everything. Games at school, interacting with other people, talking in class, having to do projects with somebody else, you know, secondary school, doing team sports, being in a play, like all those things you're forced to do, which are so hugely uncomfortable. And not knowing that I've got a sensitivity to light and sound is my biggest thing. Sound just feels like my eyes are going to come out of my head. When I was in secondary school, there's one memory where we were in assembly and I was in year seven, so I would have been sat in the front row. And there was a guy literally directly opposite me playing a guitar. He was like doing a show for an assembly. And I remember I wanted him to stop so much because of the noise. Was like physically hurting my body because it was right in front of me. And I was just had my hands like under the chair and just gripping it so, so hard because I just sat there smiling, extremely polite, but inside like dying because I wanted it to end and I couldn't say anything. I couldn't get up and walk out and say, it is physically hurting me, this music. How do you tell someone that without them, you know, thinking you're weird?
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you shared these examples of all the times you felt, okay, I should behave certain ways, because I think this is such a misconception around autism. There's this idea that those on the autism spectrum don't know what the kind of social rules are.
Mm.
And in fact, I think it's nearer to you find those difficult to relate to, you know, on the kind of more instinctual level that a lot of maybe other people do. And so, you know, the examples you've given there really illustrate that you did feel all the same social pressures to belong, to behave in certain ways, of what things will I say that will make me sound weird. And even if some of them you miss, you soon enough learn by other people's reactions. And then that goes into the cataloguing of, again, how I should behave.
Yeah, I feel even now, like an interaction with somebody, it's obviously easier with people I know now. It's still not everyone, you know, I still mask with people I would say are close friends. Of course I do, because I've done it my whole life. I don't know how not to yet. And I feel that at school, especially in teens and early 20s, every time I meet someone, it was like a checklist in my brain. I'm going down like, I don't know if an algorithm or what you want to put, like seeing what works for this person. Okay, if I say that, what's their reaction? Or I sense a subtle change in their body language, because I'm such an excellent body language because I've had to be to survive. And so I've studied people for so long to be able to fit in. So I'm really good at reading people. And I doubt if what I'm feeling is real sometimes. And people say, well, you're overthinking it. They're probably not thinking that. They're probably not in a mood. Oh, and they are. Of course they are. They're just being passive aggressive towards me because they're trying to be polite. But it is like this checklist of going down with meeting new people. Try that, didn't work. Try this thing. That worked somewhere before. And seeing what works and sort of piecing it together so I can form some connection with them. And that's... yeah, that's such a weird, when I really explain like that, it does seem strange, but that's how I've had to survive. That's how I've had to meet people and have jobs, you know, have relationships and stuff like that. It is like a checklist, and saying that might make it sound like I'm not a genuine or authentic person, but I am. And when it really matters, you know, and to people who are very genuine with me, it does matter. And I think a lot of people very close to me will know when I'm being authentic enough, like when I actually am happy to be myself. But it's taken a long time for me to just be like that around a couple of people.
Yeah. And I think this does sound very authentic, because you're authentically connecting with people to the best of your ability. But it's certain social pressures and certain stigmas that exist where you feel you have to mask the extent to which you might be doing that, for example. So there's a lot that goes unacknowledged in our most kind of day-to-day interactions. For example, like you can imagine we talk about on the show this kind of idea of people always saying they're fine rather than expressing how they really feel. You being clued into kind of studying people and that being such a normal part of your day-to-day, you're going to be like, well, they're clearly not fine.
Yeah.
But I've now got to pretend that I haven't noticed that. Whereas a lot of people, do they not notice? Do they automatically know not to acknowledge it? I'm not sure, because I'm also one of those people that notices these things. And I find that even with me becomes a bit of a natural filtering process. If you're not someone that likes to be asked how you're really feeling, you're probably going to get sick of a friendship with me real quick.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that point you just made about, I feel like I do notice a lot in people that maybe they don't even know about themselves yet. I think a lot of people, in my experience and what I've heard before, a lot of autistic people will say, you sort of have a sense that you're psychic. And I've always sort of felt like that, even as a kid, like I can sort of predict what's going to happen and what someone's going to say or how they're going to react with me or if they're off with me. Like, it's just a sixth sense. And what I'm starting to realize now is that's pattern recognition. That's where my biggest pattern recognition comes in, is people's body language. And there is definitely a pattern in things people say and then actions that they do and what that leads on to. And I can sort of talk to someone and I'll be like, well, in 6 months, they're probably going to be like that. And they are. And it's just having that pattern. It's not about being psychic at all. I can just see it. I've been studying people for so long.
Yeah.
Well, loads of books on body language and everything. I had to buy them growing up in like my early 20s to be able to fit in and learn about it, so I didn't come off completely crazy. But yeah, it's really weird now as an adult who was late diagnosed with autism and sort of really unpacking all of that, like childhood and early 20s and stuff. It's very strange trying to look through my history with autistic eyes, essentially, rather than before when I didn't know I had that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's opening up a whole load of other stuff.
No, I can imagine. And, you know, a lot of it, like you say, it's actually quite straightforward. It's practice of being a great listener, being a great observationalist. And so, yeah, you probably notice things in the same way. Like, I notice people's nervous tics really easily. Yeah. Like if somebody talks about certain topics and they start tapping the table or, like, you know, playing with a bracelet or playing with their hair more, you know, I can notice that stuff really easily because I'm used to looking out for it. It's a part of how I communicate. And we don't pick up a lot of that stuff automatically without practice. And yet, that doesn't necessarily mean somebody wants that pointed out to them, unless I know them well.
I know. There's a couple of people in my life who I will point stuff out to now, and I'd happily, if they do that with me, that's fine. But that's taken a long time to get there. And I will always ask, are you happy for me to offer my opinion on this situation right now? I'll always ask them, because some people don't want to hear it, and that's fine. I've definitely been the person who doesn't want to hear anything before in the past. So yeah, I will never say anything. And again, there's that sort of, around that sort of situation, I'm starting to question more and more, like, why can't I say something? I care about this person. Is it because it's not socially acceptable? Is it just because they might not be mentally ready for that? So I think there's still a lot around that. If it's a safe place and it's someone, you know, who you do care about and you're concerned and you maybe want to say, you know, I feel like there's this really going on. Have you thought about that? And
yeah. And also, you know, it shouldn't have to be your responsibility to be, you know, the kind of caretaker of other people's sensitivities to that extent. There's a difference between, like, you don't want to be one extreme where you're like Sherlock Holmes, just constantly listing every observation, because it makes great telly, but you wouldn't be popular in real life. And
it's so tiring.
And yet if you go to the other way and you're like super sensitive and you sort of broach things very delicately and constantly sort of handhold with other people's stuff, then, you know, you should be getting paid as a counsellor. Like, then that's the other extreme. And so, no, I get it. It's a tricky balance. And for you growing up and not being aware of a lot of this, would you mind sharing the contrast between that and then getting your later in life diagnosis?
Yeah, it's a really strange one, really. I got the diagnosis when I was 30, so that's coming up 6 years ago. Previously to that, I had been sort of in and out of a mental health, I say facility. I didn't stay there. I just had a care worker who helped me because I was misdiagnosed with so many things, which is extremely common for, I'm going to say women, I'm not. But I think of that as a totally different person now as well. It's like looking at someone else's life. So yeah, I was so misdiagnosed a lot. bipolar in there at one point. Schizophrenia was on the cards at one point. I was given a lot of different drugs, which actually made me worse rather than making me better. And the care worker I had at the time suggested, maybe you're just autistic.
And sorry, just to pause at that point, what was the external concern at that stage? So the reason for, you know, other people thinking you need a diagnosis and you need medication, what was the particular behaviour?
Yeah, I would probably describe it, I was having some sort of breakdown. There's such a pattern in my life, in my history, where I stay in jobs for about 2, maybe 3 years max. And there's a pattern like that's like the same. Yeah, same with relationships. Yeah, it's like I reach my threshold and I'm done. And then there's sort of this huge breakdown of like meltdowns, shutdowns, becoming mute, which I was a lot like that after school. I'd come home and just be silent for hours because I physically just couldn't do anything. And that carried on into adulthood and still now after certain situations. So I think I was going to the doctor and obviously thinking I was just depressed. I was like, well, I've probably got depression. Yeah, it's just depression and having drugs. And it was just sort of slowly getting worse and worse. And I had a younger brother who was diagnosed with autism. And I remember, this was a couple of years before I had my diagnosis, and we had to sort of fill out a form as a family, which was really strange. And I remember when we were sort of looking through, I was like, this is all me. Like, this sounds just like me growing up. This is funny. Didn't really think much of it. And then, yeah, when my care worker sort of said, you know, I think you might just be autistic, because she had a daughter at the time who was 14, who was just being diagnosed. So I started doing a lot of research myself online of autism in women. Never really thought about women having it at all, ever. It was, you know, when I was, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s at this point, still really hadn't thought about women having it. And I read everything online and my mind just exploded. I was like, this is me. I'm reading my life. Someone's written my life online somewhere without me knowing. That's what it felt like. It was such a huge relief. I just felt so happy. And I was like, wow, everything makes sense. Of course I am. You know, this is incredible. And that didn't last very long, that sort of amazing feeling. And because then I had to go for the sort of test that they do, which was just absolutely horrific. And it was just so childish. And I was a 30-year-old woman. It was just horrible. And they just treated me like a 6-year-old boy. It was very strange. And then I got the diagnosis.
I've heard you describe that as there were toys involved and, you know, magazines.
The table of toys. I had to pick what toy I would play with. And I was like, what? This is really strange. Yeah, they would ask me questions about, do I understand? One of the sayings a guy asked me, he said, do you know what getting under my skin means? Like that saying, you get under my skin. And I was like, yeah, I understand it, but I also don't understand it, because I understand it for a neurotypical person, what they're actually trying to say. What they're trying to say is, you annoy me, you're getting under my skin. Just say you annoy me. Don't have to say it with this saying. And so they asked me a few questions like that as well to see if I sort of understood. And then, yeah, I had to pretend, make a cup of tea in thin air, just with no, he was like, show me how you make a cup of tea. I was like, okay. Very, very strange as a 30-year-old adult. I was like, okay. So yeah, I got the diagnosis. I was handed some leaflets about support, which was mainly aimed at men. And then that was it. And at the time of the diagnosis, I was also in a very mentally abusive relationship. So I didn't really think much about the autism until I was about 32 when I got out of the relationship, because I just didn't have the mental space for that. I was being mentally abused, and he very much used my autism against me a lot. He used it as a very negative way. He used to call me disabled all the time, and just lots of ways my autism would always come up. And I started to hate it because I was being brainwashed and had lots of gaslighting and all those, being coerced and all those sorts of things. So for those sort of 2 years after, I didn't really acknowledge it or think much more about my autism. And I think I read one book, which was actually quite helpful, but that was it. I didn't sort of put it out of my mind. Then I got out of the relationship. I still didn't really think about it. And I ended up in a very, very bad mental place. And I had a severe eating disorder at the time, suicide ideation. I was very sort of mentally ill. So it's only really the last sort of 3 years I've fully sort of started owning it and really looking into how it affects me, mm-hmm. being autistic. So yeah, I got diagnosis, didn't think about it, then started thinking about it again. So it was a very strange journey in my 30s.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I can imagine. Very common strange time of life though, isn't it? A lot of transitions.
Yeah.
And am I right in thinking that as part of the abuse, your autism diagnosis then became like a scapegoat or like a thing that formed part of the gaslighting, like, oh, you're reading the situation wrong because?
Yeah, it was used against me so much. It was used against me in that way. And then also if I did anything wrong, it'd be like, oh, you're stupid because you're autistic. It was sort of that. So,
well, and so of course you're going to have this negative association with it.
Yeah, and I hated myself. I hated myself anyway, but I hated myself even more within that relationship. And it did get really bad. And eventually, yeah, when I did leave and sort of had a moment maybe thinking about it again, but then I just got worse from there. And as I said, I was forming an eating disorder, which really hit its peak in my early 30s. You know, anorexia, bulimia, very, very, very ill. And again, there wasn't really acknowledging having autism. I was in and out of an eating disorder unit and I would tell them I was autistic, but how they managed me wasn't any different to anyone else. And looking back now, I think it should have been. I think the programs didn't work for me because I was autistic. It doesn't work like that in my brain. CBT doesn't work for my brain. It just doesn't. And that was a lot of the sort of programs they gave me. And I know everyone is different. I'm not saying all autistic people need the same type of therapy, but there is definitely a difference there with what is actually handed out as standard for everyone. Because what's standard for everyone? Well, you know, it's not covering all the different sort of ethnicities or cultures or anything or whatever you might have. It, you know, one thing doesn't fit everyone, which we know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you very much had that confirmed also through that experience of diagnosis as well, that the diagnostics model around autism is so informed by the male experience of it and by the average age when males are diagnosed. It's interesting around this conversation of masking because, you know, I feel like there's a gender element here as well. Mm. You know, we were talking off air about, you know, all the ways in which women can be expected that if they feel uncomfortable, they smile. Then they, you know, that can be so the encouragement. You know, even in the way you describe the diagnosis there, you've got all these, I've heard you talk about it before, and you've got all these toys and magazines, you know, to do with tractors and, you know, things that we stereotype as like male toys growing up. So what, if you'd not connected with those, that might have jeopardized your diagnosis? Or if you'd not realized that when they asked you about, do you understand what this phrase means, if you'd said yes versus yes, I understand what it means to other people, but I don't really get it. If you'd not phrased it in that way, then how easily, even at that stage, a diagnosis maybe would have been missed.
Because I was so worried I wouldn't get it. And there was an element of me masking within that, because which just proves even more that I'm autistic, because I wanted to make sure I had the diagnosis because I knew that I was. I really, without a doubt, I knew that I was. And the fear of not getting it was so horrible. I did think, well, what does this guy want me to actually say? And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people feel like that. I came out being really scared and having to wait for the letter to say whether or not it was horrible. It was really, I didn't get told there and then. I had to wait. Not a nice place to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it sounds almost like you're describing like a reverse masking, where you're like, I need to force myself to not do the impulses. And you know, that's why I think, you know, I mentioned gender, because it just really doesn't feel unrelated in your experience. And even, you know, the extent to maybe how good your masking was. I know that in friends of mine, I'm thinking of one in particular, for example, Clara, who's been on the show, would often describe experiences where she'd be treated as stupid if she didn't get something that other people got. And she'd wonder, like, if I was a man, would I be as likely to be treated as thick in that situation? Or would it maybe be a funny thing that I didn't get a certain phrase, or that I took something literally that wasn't meant as such? You know, it was a sort of laughing with versus laughing at. You know, and it's scary that gender still plays such a role in these nuanced ways. Would you mind sharing a bit about, I know for yourself, there's a step further than this, where autism then helped you understand your experience of gender better.
Yeah, I think, like, talking about your friend there, those, I've had exactly the same experience of, I've said something, it might seem stupid because maybe I don't understand something as quickly as someone else. It's like, oh, you're an idiot. And being like, oh, maybe I am an idiot. And so, yeah, exactly the same. And that was being, yeah, because I was socialized as a woman. And looking back now on my life, it's very obvious that I was failing completely as being socialized as a girl and as a woman completely. And I always felt inside me that I was failing, especially when I was in relationships with men. I never felt I was doing it properly. I wasn't, you know, being the role of a woman in the relationship very well. I couldn't do it. And I've always was told I was more tomboyish. I don't like that term, but I was, you know, that's what I was called a lot growing up. And, you know, I never really had, I did wear dresses and stuff, but I've never been into makeup or anything. You know, the traditional things that girls and women are sort of meant to be interested in. A lot of my friends sort of were, and I was just like, well, I'm definitely not. And I had to sort of pretend. And it's very obvious to me now about how I feel about my gender now. And my mum says that as well. And she just didn't know anything about it at the time. You know, growing up in the 90s, I don't remember anything like that ever hearing about these things or knowing that there was another way for me to go down. But my experiences being socialized, especially as a young woman in my 20s, was very much, my existence was solely based on how I looked. And that's still really hard for me to unpack now, because I was told my whole life, you're really pretty, you're the prettiest sibling, or you're really good looking, you're the best looking person here. And that's all anyone ever said about me. No one ever talked about my personality, or, you know, the fact that I loved nature or dogs. I was completely obsessed with dogs. No one ever talked about things that I feel are important about a person, not about how I look. I was always told to smile and look nice. And, you know, you should always just be there for men. You should, you know, have sex with a man because that's what men want, and not about whether I wanted to or not. It wasn't about my choices and what I felt comfortable with. Yeah, my whole existence was based around how I look. And I felt I was never good looking enough for anyone, ever, because, you know, it's just such a horrible thing to be told. Even people in my family, just no one ever talked about my personality. And that might be because, looking back, I was masking so much, so probably no one really knew who I was. It was probably a little bit different for everyone, like trying to fit in and survive and not being able to show who I was. And with being socialized so much as a woman, that's really affected personal relationships. And as I said, that constant feeling of failing and being in relationships, and maybe automatically me taking the role of cleaning everything and cooking and doing all those things that women are meant to do, because that's what I was told and that's what I saw in films and everything. It was all about that, and that was my role, and I could sustain that for 2 years. Then my threshold would hit and I'd be like, I'm done, like, I can't do this, have a complete breakdown and try and escape. And that obviously affected me having an eating disorder as well. Yeah, you can't live like that. You can't live thinking I have to look perfect all the time for everyone, because I'm not perfect at all. I am not at all.
It's not even aspirational. Like, I really don't think we like perfect people either, because, you know, you only need to look at how our media treats anyone that has an incredible career, particularly women. Mm. There's this chomping at the bit for an excuse to tear them down.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's another layer of sort of my existence so far, was when I was good at something, I was really good at sport at school, really good at PE, loved it because I was outside and I could just run. I was really good at cross country, and I wasn't good at anything like sprinting. The teacher would try and get me to sprint. I was like, I literally can't sprint. I am a slow, not slow, but I just have endurance. I can just endure something for a really long time. Cross country was great. I could run away and just run forever. And when I was good at it, I would then get picked on. You know, the girls at school bullied me because I was good looking. And then it's just such a conflict. I'm like, well, what do you want me to be? Do you want me to be good looking? Do you not want me to be good looking? Do you want me to be good at something? Because then if I am good at it, you then say I'm making you feel bad. And even into my late 20s and very early 30s, when I was having like a huge breakdown, I really got into triathlon and I was really good at it. And there were people in my club who would be like, oh, you're really good. And it's not fair. And I'm like, I haven't eaten for days. All I've had is water and I'm trying to do a triathlon. You don't know what's going on inside me. And I was so confused. And I just felt, what should I be for people? I don't know what to be because nothing seems to work. I'm being attractive. I'm being good at sport. I'm being here for men. I'm doing exactly what men want me to do and what just people want me to. But then I'm annoying people in my family. I'm annoying friends. I'm annoying people on the club because I'm really good. And it was horrible. I just didn't know. And that's when I had a huge breakdown. Completely I lost it. Yeah. It was a really bad, bad place. Because I've been trying for 30 plus years to be what everyone wanted me to be and I couldn't.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you for sharing that. It's so articulately said because, you know, that in essence is a big part of the burden of experiencing autism is trying so hard and putting so much mental and physical energy into fitting in a world where fitting in doesn't make sense. There's not a huge amount of logic to it anyway. And people will get picked on for all kinds of strengths and or weaknesses. And so I think we'll start wrapping up on that note. I also just want to quickly highlight, you know, that's why in some of what you've described there, that's why I love phrases like, you know, socialized as a woman or, you know, talking about toys being stereotyped as female or male, because there's these little ways with language where we can undermine the normalization of such things. You know, it's something I learned from Akala, a rapper and author who often writes about race. And he talks about people being racialized as black because it's not science. It's to do with people's perception. It's to do with people's assumptions. And so rather than even describing himself as black, he'll describe himself as racialized as black. And, you know, I think it can be very powerful to kind of undermine assumptions in this way.
Which is so, like you say, it's so important. Just the small thing that you could say actually just has a different effect in someone's mind. It really is, yeah, there's a lot to be learned still in how we talk about anything really. So yeah, huge.
I love language. So before I go off on a monologue, we will wrap up there. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to find you online, if people want to find out more about your story, where can they go?
So the story of the campaign with the National Autistic Society is on their website. So just Google National Autistic Society anywhere. And all across their social media platforms as well, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And you can see there's six of us on the campaign and you'll be able to see all our individual stories and our videos. If you want to follow me personally, I'm on Instagram and Greenhouse Lex. I am on TikTok, but it's mainly just me to watch videos, so don't worry too much. But Instagram as well, post most of my sort of stuff and my sort of story so far and things like that about gender and autism things. So, yeah. And if anyone ever does want to message me, please just ask me anything. I'm really happy about people messaging me. I love it.
Cool. Love that. All right. We'll wrap up there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.